This is Audible.
For my wife, Katie, and my daughter, Maisie.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Rebel Yell, The Violence, Passion, and Redemption of Stonewall Jackson by S.C. Gwynn. Read by Cotter Smith.
And yet the only man of those men who pass, with a strange, secretive grain of harsh poetry hidden so deep in the stony sides of his heart that it shines by flashes only and then is gone. It glitters in his last words. Stephen Vincent Benet, John Brown's Body. He bowed the heavens also and came down with thick darkness under his feet. He made darkness his hiding place, his canopy around him, darkness of waters, thick clouds of the skies. Psalm 18. Prologue, Legends of Spring. On the brilliantly clear afternoon of June 19, 1862, in the second year of the Great Civil War, a well-dressed, bespectacled Confederate congressman with a trim beard named Alexander Robinson Boatler stood on a platform at the train station in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was on war business, traveling under the personal orders of General Robert E. Lee. He had just arrived from Richmond, having made the 70-mile journey by rail across the blossoming, river-cut hills of the Piedmont country. Now, as he gazed about him, Boatler realized that something quite unusual was happening. The normally sleepy college town of Charlottesville, he observed, was in a fever of excitement. There was noise and commotion everywhere, though to no particular purpose. Some sort of large-scale military movement was underway, but no one, neither citizens nor soldiers, could say exactly what it was. Theories abounded. A dozen empty trains had passed mysteriously through the station earlier that day, all headed west, toward the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Shenandoah Valley. None had returned. A cordon of gray-uniformed soldiers had virtually sealed the town off from the outside world, for security reasons, presumably, though what knowledge any of its citizens could possibly have imparted to the enemy was hard to say. All anyone knew was that whatever was taking place was a very large secret. Lee's orders to Boatler, in fact, had simply been to stop at Charlottesville and await orders, which seemed as cryptic as everything else that was happening that day. Boatler thought he knew what was happening. He was one of perhaps five people on Earth who could make that claim, and watching the excitement build around him in the warm spring air, he had a clear sense that he stood at one of the pivot points of the war. Great events, as he put it later, were on the gale. He was in a position to know. He was a new breed of Southern politician, spawned entirely by the exigencies of war. A former U.S. congressman from Western Virginia, he had been one of the last representatives from a Southern state to abandon the Union and had promptly been elected to the first Confederate Congress. Soon he was wielding power in a way he never had in Washington, indeed in a way that had never been done before in American politics or anticipated by the men who had designed the country's democratic systems. Genial, persistent, and charismatic, Boatler acted as a liaison between Confederate armies in the field and the capital at Richmond. He moved easily between the two worlds, an insider in both. He occupied himself with issues of military supplies and munitions, with the devastations of war on the towns in his district, even of the movements of Union armies. He'd become a sort of wartime public relations officer and courier, the link between the generals and the politicians. That was the work he was performing that day on the train platform in Charlottesville. But he was doing it now under more perilous conditions than the new Confederate nation had ever experienced. The Richmond he had left that morning was a changed city, a shaken city, where it seemed that if all hell was not yet breaking loose and full panic not quite abroad in the city's streets, both soon would be. In spite of the Confederacy's conviction, bordering on absolute certainty, that the war would be brief, relatively bloodless, heroic, and victorious, the new nation suddenly found itself on the brink of an undreamed-of disaster. Just east of Richmond spread the campfires of an enormous Union army. With 120,000 soldiers, it was the largest military force in the Western Hemisphere and one of the greatest concentrations of sheer firepower in human history. Its sole purpose, pursued doggedly through the mud and swollen streams of the York James Peninsula for more than 3 months, was to conquer and occupy the city of Richmond. Confederate troops, some 50,000 of them under General Joseph E. Johnston, had fallen steadily back to the capital in a soggy, dispiriting retreat, fighting rearguard actions but unable to challenge the enemy's crushing numerical superiority. And now that same Union army, under the guidance of the estimable General George B. McClellan, had bivouacked so close to Richmond that its soldiers could hear the city's church bells. Measured in raw military muscle, the confrontation was a grotesque mismatch. 65,000 Confederates, including the city's defense force, with inferior weaponry against this moon tide of blue-coated troops, equipped with the most sophisticated martial hardware in the world. Worse still, the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia was now commanded by a man with, at best, a shaky reputation as a fighter, Robert E. Lee. He had assumed command of the army just 2.5 weeks before, succeeding the wounded Johnston. Though he was a veteran of the Mexican-American War, had once held the job of superintendent at West Point, and was admired within military circles, this new war had already demonstrated with cruel clarity that dusty military laurels were no guarantee of victory. In the fifth month of the war, Lee had lost a campaign at Cheat Mountain in Western Virginia, where his retreat had earned him the nickname Evacuating Lee. He had other less than flattering sobriquets, too. Officers who considered him a bit fussy and cautious for army work called him Granny Lee. The soldiers who had obeyed his orders to dig breastworks around Richmond in anticipation of McClellan's attack, finding this an inglorious task for men whose purpose was to stand up and fight, had dubbed him the King of Spades. He had spent most of the war in an office in Richmond as a sort of glorified military sidekick to the West Point-educated Jefferson Davis, a former U.S. Secretary of War who had himself fought in Mexico. The Confederate capital, moreover, was more than just the seat of government. It represented a huge component of the South's industrial and financial might. Its Tredegar Ironworks were the largest of their kind in the South, supplying half of all artillery in the Confederacy, much of its munitions, and most of its locomotive building capacity. Its warehouses had become the main source of military supply for the war's eastern theater. Richmond was also the source of Confederate currency and the repository of the gold that backed it. The government was so worried about this that as McClellan's army had muscled closer to the city, the Treasury's gold reserves had been loaded onto a special train whose boilers held a full head of steam at all times, ready to depart at short notice. Without the gold, Confederate dollars were worthless. And if they were worthless, then the Confederate government would be unable to pay for its war. Preparations had already been made to ship military papers and government archives to Columbia, South Carolina, while Virginia legislators had voted to burn Richmond rather than surrender it to the Yankees. As though to underscore just how close Richmond was to falling, President Davis had sent his wife and children south, to Raleigh, out of harm's way. Northern newspapers were already crowing about what seemed certain victory. The math was inescapable. And citizens of the North could now, finally, after 14 bloody and frustrating months of war, look forward to Richmond's fall with grim satisfaction and comfort themselves that a long, overdue moral lesson was about to be administered to the traitorous enemy. "It is believed in town," wrote Washingtonian Elizabeth Blair Lee to her husband in the Union Navy, "that Virginia will be evacuated without a fight." Others were convinced that the war itself would be over by July 4th. As panic and resignation seeped through the streets of Richmond, many Southerners seemed to be of the same mind. "I am ready to sink with despair," wrote Jefferson Davis's niece, to her mother on May 7. It was in this explosive climate that Alexander Boteler had made his train trip west from Richmond. On the platform, he heard the scream of an engine, and then watched in some amazement as an unscheduled eastbound train came thundering into the station, as he later put it, and groaned to a stop, trailing great clouds of smoke. The train was a bizarre sight, so overloaded with Confederate troops, some 2,000 of them jammed inside the cars and on their roofs, that, as Boteler observed, they seemed to cover them all over like a cluster of bees. Then he spotted, amid the roar and the hubbub on the station platform, the lone figure seated on a bench in the postal car behind the tender. Considering what the man looked like, it was amazing that Boteler, or anyone else for that matter, noticed him at all. He wore a tattered, faded, and mud-flecked uniform, whose shoulders had been bleached yellow by the sun, large artillery boots, and a soiled cap pulled down across the bridge of his nose so that much of his face was obscured. His hair was long and his beard unkempt. He was what most of the thousands of people who saw him and later recorded their observations might have called nondescript. The distinction was his coat's star-emblazoned collar. The rumpled man was a major general in the Confederate Army. His name was Thomas J. Jackson, though most Southerners already knew him as Stonewall, a nickname he had earned at the Battle of Manassas 11 months earlier. Boteler was, in fact, a part-time member of Jackson's staff. Since the beginning of the war, he had been the general's political eyes and ears in Richmond. He was Jackson's PR man, Jackson's courier and factotum, Jackson's lobbyist, and Jackson's political confidant. And it was on Jackson's behalf that Boteler ran most of his errands, including several direct appeals to the legislature. He had been instrumental in getting Jackson appointed to his command in the first place, and he was even now carrying a personal letter for Jackson that Robert E. Lee had given him the night before. Jackson recognized Boteler, waved him aboard, and the two men shook hands. Jackson asked him if he had a pencil and paper. Boteler replied that he did. "Then sit down, please," Jackson said, "and write as I shall dictate to you." For the next few minutes, while the overstuffed train rested at the platform and the citizens of Charlottesville tried in vain to understand exactly what they were seeing, Jackson spooled out a string of high-speed orders, dictating details of the complex eastward transfer of his 18,500-man army by train and by road, a sort of layered hopscotching mechanism and a method of troop transfer new to the ways of war in North America. Jackson finished and said goodbye to Boteler, who stepped back onto the platform. The train slipped away from the station, vanishing amid the swirls of smoke into the rolling forest of the Virginia Piedmont. An hour later, at the junction town of Gordonsville, the same train startled troops from the 4th North Carolina Regiment, who were on guard duty at the time. They had been told nothing about a troop train bearing several thousand soldiers heading east. "This arrival came on us like a thunderclap," wrote one in a letter. "There is some important movement on hand, but no one can even surmise what it is." They were even more surprised when a few moments later they received another astonishing piece of information in the form of the very ordinary-looking, shabbily dressed, yet unmistakable officer whose face flashed by them in the windows of the train. The reason that the soldiers had known nothing about their commander's whereabouts and intentions was because great pains had been taken under Jackson's strict orders to conceal them. His own generals had no idea where he was. They complained loudly about it, too, unable to understand how such absurd levels of concealment could possibly advance the cause of the Confederacy. 2 days before, Jackson had instructed his cavalry chief to send all dispatches directly to him, thus bypassing all normal channels of command, and also to meet him secretly, specifying only that, "I will be on my horse at the north end of town," and asking that the officer not inquire after him, since he did not want his own soldiers to know where he was. His own top lieutenant, General Richard Ewell, had been under the false impression that his army was moving north, and when he received his orders, they merely told him to march in the direction of Charlottesville, his ultimate destination unknown. Jackson's peculiar deceptions had worked brilliantly on the enemy, too. The Union Army's best intelligence placed him with up to 40,000 men at 5 separate locations within a 100-mile radius, one of which was at or near the Potomac River boundaries of Washington, D.C. Until Boteler saw the train pull in, even he had had no idea exactly where Jackson and his army were. And, of course, the common soldier, as usual, knew nothing at all. "I do not know whether we are going to march north, south, east, or west, or whether we're going to march at all," complained one of them who was camped in the area. "And that is about all I will ever know of Jackson's plans." But at least one thing was certain. Something very big was underway. Jackson was going east. It is a matter of record that a mere 14 months earlier, the man everyone from Charlottesville to Washington was so breathlessly concerned about had been an obscure, eccentric, and unpopular college professor in a small town in rural Virginia. He had odd habits, a strangely silent manner, a host of health problems, and was thought by almost everyone who knew him to be lacking in even the most basic skills of leadership. To call him a failure is probably too harsh. He just wasn't very good at anything. He was part of that great undifferentiated mass of second-rate humanity who weren't going anywhere in life. And yet, on that bright June day in Charlottesville, the oddball science teacher had just completed a military campaign in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley that made him the most famous military figure in the Western world. In a matter of months, he had undergone a transformation of such speed and magnitude that it stood out in a war that made a specialty of such changes. Ulysses S. Grant, the most famous of these war-induced transformations, was a washout from the Army and a failure in business. When the war began, he was employed as a clerk in his father's leather store in Galena, Illinois. William Tecumseh Sherman, a failed banker who had landed at a tiny military academy in Louisiana, was another. Jackson's rise to fame, power, and legend was every bit as deep and transfiguring as that of the two Union generals, but it happened much faster, and his ascent was much steeper. His metamorphosis began in the first year of the war, with his brilliant performance in the Confederate victory at Manassas. But it was rooted mainly in an extraordinary campaign that had begun on March 23 and ended on June 9, 1862. What Jackson did in those 78 days, in a small and dazzlingly beautiful theater of war, bounded by mountain ranges on either side, redefined the conflict and made him the most celebrated field commander in the war. Though the particulars of each battle or skirmish could be quite complex, their significance, seen collectively, was strikingly clear and simple. Using a combination of speed, deception, and sheer audacity, Jackson, with 17,000 men, and often far fewer, had taken on and beaten Union forces that, though never united, totaled more than 52,000. He marched his men at a pace unknown to soldiers of the day, covering an astounding 646 miles in 48 days, fighting 5 major battles, and skirmishing almost daily. He made flashing strikes in unexpected places, falling on the enemy from behind mountain ranges and out of steep passes. With his small force, he had driven 4 Union armies from the greater part of the Shenandoah Valley, inflicting 5,000 casualties, capturing 3,500 prisoners, an immense quantity of stores and supplies, and seizing 9,000 small arms. He had evaded a massive pincer movement designed by Abraham Lincoln himself to catch him. Then, in the most stunning maneuver of all, he had turned on both jaws of the pincer, 2 Union armies, and beaten them in succession. In a war where the techniques of marching and fighting were being reinvented almost literally hour by hour, Jackson's intelligence, speed, aggression, and pure arrogance were the wonders of North and South alike. They were the talk of salons in London and Paris. Jackson's success was all the more striking because it had come amid so many Confederate defeats, just as that feeling of despair that Jefferson Davis's niece described had begun to descend on the entire beleaguered South. Confederates had lost major battles that spring at Shiloh and Forts Donelson and Henry in Tennessee. New Orleans had surrendered. Most of Kentucky and Tennessee were lost, as was part of the Carolina coast. News of what Jackson had done in the valley was rolling off Southern presses at the very moment that McClellan's giant army was shouldering its way up the York James Peninsula toward Richmond. Jackson's victories not only drove the enemy from a large part of Virginia, his successes had also frozen in place and then diverted another army, some 40,000 troops camped near Fredericksburg, Virginia, that had been ready to move against Richmond. If those troops had arrived on the city's undefended west side, complementing the 120,000 on the east, Richmond would have had little choice but to surrender. That had been the Union's grand plan, and Jackson had laid waste to it. In that sense, he had already saved Richmond, or at least he had bought it time. More than anything else, perhaps, he had given Southern morale a tremendous lift in its darkest hour. He had shown that an undermanned Confederate army could outmarch, outmaneuver, and outfight much larger and better-equipped Yankee forces. He had even proven, the math works out almost perfectly, the old Southern chestnut that one rebel was worth at least three cowardly Yanks. That ratio was probably not random or accidental. In the larger war, some 2.1 million Union soldiers eventually took up arms against 880,000 Confederates. By the time Jackson passed through Charlottesville that day, a mere 10 days after the closing battle of his Valley campaign, Confederate papers were already hailing him as the new national idol. The Richmond Whig asserted that he wears the sword of the Lord of Gideon, and proclaimed that he has been chawing up Yankees by the thousands as if they were so many grains of parched popcorn. The Richmond Daily Dispatch called him simply the hero of the war, hailing him as a decisive genius and comparing his rapid marches, profound calculations, and energetic attack to the legendary Italian campaign of Napoleon Bonaparte. The North, meanwhile, had gotten the notion that Jackson was a Southern version of the abolitionist John Brown, a man who worshipped a grim Old Testament god of vengeance, a holy warrior who wielded a strange and powerful influence over his men. Some said he was simply a remorseless killer, nearly as hard on his own troops as he was on the enemy. But no one really knew. Not yet. Jackson, the dusty, rumpled man on the train, was still almost completely shrouded in mystery. He was traveling east by train that day because Robert E. Lee, a man with whom he would soon develop a partnership that changed the course of the Civil War, had summoned him. And because Lee was about to launch a hazardous, many would have deemed it suicidal, attempt to drive McClellan's army away from the gates of the capital, and he wanted Jackson in its vanguard. Though it would take several days for this closely guarded information to spread through the rank and file, the reaction when it came was one of almost delirious joy. "Jackson is coming," was the rumor that swept through the Confederate regiments in front of the city. "In our sultry, squalid camps along the Chickahominy," wrote one soldier who was bivouacked in the swampy lowlands east of Richmond, "the news had reached us of the brilliant Valley campaign, and in the midst of destitution and depression and doubt, with the enemy at the very gates of the capital, Jackson's victories read like a fairy tale. With feverish interest we devoured the accounts of rapid marches, of sudden appearances where least expected, which had frustrated every combination of the enemy." To them, Jackson's movement east, with his vaunted Army of the Valley, meant that he was coming to save Richmond, which meant that he was coming to save the Confederacy. And the soldiers of the beleaguered Army of Northern Virginia believed to the bottom of their ragged, malnourished rebel souls that he was going to do precisely that. Part 1. The Unimagined War. Chapter 1. Away to Richmond. For Thomas J. Jackson, the war started precisely at 12:30 p.m. on the afternoon of April 21, 1861, in the small Shenandoah Valley town of Lexington, Virginia. As beginnings go, it was grand, even glorious. Fort Sumter had fallen to the rebels on April 13. Virginia had seceded on the 17th, and since then its citizens had been in the grip of a sort of collective delirium that had sent them thronging into the streets. It was that way everywhere in the country, north and south. Though no one could say what was going to happen next, or where it might happen, and very few knew what it might be like to actually shoot another human being, Americans everywhere felt a new and joyous sense of clarity and purpose. War would be the way forward. Not the old-fashioned idea of war as horror and heartbreak, but a new and heady notion of grand adventure and impending glory. And so Lexington, a quiet, picturesque college town of 2,135, on a hilltop at the southern end of the valley, was being turned into an armed camp, in the happiest possible sense of that term. Volunteer companies were organized in the streets, militiamen marched to and fro, students from Washington College drilled under their Greek teacher, ladies sewed regimental flags and mended socks, lunches were packed, old squirrel guns and fowling pieces and muskets from the War of 1812 were dragged out of storage, cleaned, and oiled. There was an atmosphere of picnic and parade. As one Confederate soldier recalled, those days were the only time we can remember when citizens walked along the lines offering their pocketbooks to men whom they did not know, that fair women bestowed their floral offerings and kisses ungrudgingly and with equal favor among all classes of friends and suitors, when the distinctions of wealth and station were forgotten and each departing soldier was equally honored as the hero. Meanwhile, across town at the Virginia Military Institute, the South's oldest military college, the cadets were embarking on a solemn mission. 3 days before, their superintendent had received orders from the governor to send them immediately to Richmond to help drill the raw recruits who were arriving in large numbers. Now, in the warm sunshine of the Sabbath morning of April 21, on a promontory high above the north branch of the James River, and with the mountains rising in the distance, they were preparing to do just that. Around noon, 176 of them were in line in front of their castellated barracks, young, fresh-faced, and deliberately serious, with their cheeks aglow and their eyes sparkling with the expectation of the military glory awaiting them, as one observer recalled. They wore short-billed kepis and shell jackets with brass buttons. They stood at attention, four small companies in eight immaculate lines. Flanking them was their baggage train, wagons loaded with equipment and drivers mounted, whips in hand, waiting for the command to move out. It was a grand and inspiring scene, for little Lexington anyway, and a crowd of people had gathered on Institute Hill to watch it. In front of the cadets stood their commander, the unimposing Major Thomas J. Jackson. He was 37 years old, trim, bearded, a bit gaunt, and a shade under 6 feet tall. You would have noticed his pale blue-gray eyes, his high, wide forehead, and his thin, bloodless lips, which always seemed tightly pressed together. For the occasion, he had worn his very best uniform, a faded, dark blue, double-breasted coat with a major's epaulettes, blue trousers with gold piping, a sword, sash, and forage cap. It is worth taking inventory of him at the moment he rode off to war. Though he held himself ramrod straight on the parade ground, his bearing seemed odd, even to a casual observer. More awkward than military. More graceless than dignified. He had large hands and feet, and seemed not to know quite what to do with them. And this strangely stiff posture suggested exactly how these cadets saw him, as a perfect martinet, a humorless, puritanical, gimlet-eyed stickler for detail, a strict enforcer of every rule and regulation. He was such a literalist when it came to duty that he had once, while in the army, worn heavy winter underwear into summer because he had received no specific order to change it. Once, when seated on a camp stool with his saber across his knees, He was told by VMI's superintendent to remain as you are until further orders. The next morning, the superintendent found him seated on the camp stool in the same position, because, according to Jackson, you ordered me to remain here. He insisted that his students obey his orders just as unquestioningly. He was as painfully formal in conversation as he was in class. Worse still, from the students' point of view, he not only taught the school's toughest and most loathed course, natural and experimental philosophy, essentially what we call physics, though it included math and such other disciplines as optics and astronomy, he was also, by universal acclaim, VMI's worst teacher. Though he was presumed to understand the dreaded Bartlett's optics textbook that he taught, he was unable to impart that wisdom to his students. He insisted on rote recitation. He explained little or nothing. He had survived an attempt led by the school's alumni 6 years before to get rid of him for all of those reasons. Jackson also taught artillery drill, at which he seemed only marginally more competent than he was as a science teacher. He seemed in other ways to be a man who had at least found his place in the world. He'd been born in modest circumstances in Clarksburg, in northwestern Virginia, now West Virginia, orphaned at 7, and raised mainly by his uncle, who owned a grist mill and farm. In spite of a poor childhood education, he had somehow made it through West Point. Though he was childless, he was said to be happily married. He was known to everyone as a devout Christian. He was a deacon in the Presbyterian Church, to which he devoted a good deal of his time. He had a very decent brick house in town and a small farm in the country, and owned 6 slaves. Those who knew him well could also have told you that he was a victim of a host of physical ailments, real and imagined, and that he traveled long distances in search of water cures that involved both drinking and soaking in supposedly healing waters. That his diet was odd, too, often consisting of water and stale bread, or buttermilk and stale bread. And he was so resolute about this that he carried his own stale bread with him when invited out to dinner. As he stood by the barracks inspecting his troops that day, he might have been charitably described as a comfortable mediocrity. A decent enough man, a harmless eccentric, an upstanding Christian and good citizen who, unfortunately, was an inept teacher. It is worth noting that the preceding description is far from complete. There was a good deal more to him even then than most of his students or colleagues ever suspected. More, indeed, of what made him great later on. He held his secrets close. He was never what he seemed to be. Not in Lexington, not later in the war. There was, however, one item that stood out on Major Jackson's curriculum vitae as of that bright April afternoon. That was his conspicuous, and to many uncharacteristic, record in the Mexican-American War in 1847. Though he seemed to most of his acquaintances in Lexington to have the personality of neither warrior nor leader, it was said that he had exhibited great bravery in battle, and that the commanding general Winfield Scott himself had singled out the young Jackson for praise. Students and faculty at VMI had heard the story, though it made no particular sense to them. Jackson seemed the furthest thing from a hero. Whether this brief, anomalous glory held any meaning in the year 1861, no one could yet say. A little after noon, Jackson removed his cap and called out loudly, "Let us pray." The pastor of the local Presbyterian Church, the Reverend Dr. William S. White, piped up with a short prayer followed by a collective Amen. It was time to go. Or it would have been if someone other than Jackson had been commanding. Though the battalion was ready to move out, in fact the cadets were dying with joy and anticipation, Jackson insisted that it depart precisely at 12:30 as planned. Jackson was a fanatic about duty, and duty dictated punctuality, and he was not, merely for the sake of this romantic war that everyone seemed to want, going to waive his rules. When his second-in-command, Raleigh Colston, a teacher of foreign languages, approached him and said, "Everything is ready, sir. Shall I give the command forward?" Jackson's answer was eclipsed, "No." They would wait. Jackson sat on a camp stool, unmoving, while the minutes ticked by. Finally, as the college bells rang 12:30, Jackson mounted his horse, wheeled toward the cadets, then shouted, "Right face! By file left! March!" As the young men marched, Jackson remained motionless and expressionless. One cadet later recalled how stiffly he sat on his horse as the column moved past him. Thus, they went off to war. To the sound of fife and drum, Jackson somewhat awkwardly shepherding the small column that contained the sons of some of the South's most prominent families. A mile away, across the small bridge that spanned the river, lay the carriages, wagons, and stagecoaches that would take them to the town of Stanton, where they would board a train for Richmond. The moment was sweetly sad, as were moments like this that were taking place across the country. It would have been sadder still if the assembled onlookers had known that Jackson and many of his ruddy-cheeked charges would never see Lexington again. Behind the pomp and circumstance lay the curious fact that the stern, inelegant man leading the column had done everything in his power to prevent the war that he was now marching off to fight. He hated the very idea of it. His conviction was in part due to his peculiar ability, shared by few people who landed in power on either side. Union Generals Winfield Scott and William Tecumseh Sherman come prominently to mind, to grasp early on just how terrible the suffering caused by the war would be, and just how long it was likely to last. The detail-obsessed physics professor's embrace of such a large abstraction is perhaps an appropriate introduction to the man himself. Jackson's brilliance was that he understood war. He understood it at some primary visceral level that escaped almost everyone else. He understood it even before it happened. In the months leading up to the war, Jackson had remained a confirmed Unionist. He opposed secession. Though he was a slave owner, he held no strident pro-slavery views. Indeed, his wife Anna wrote that she was very confident that he would never have fought for the sole object of perpetuating slavery. He had attended West Point, had been in combat under the flag of the United States of America, and had later served in the country's peacetime army. He was a patriot in the larger sense of the word. As a Christian, he was shocked by what he saw as the ungodly and inappropriate enthusiasm on both sides to settle their differences by fighting. "People who are anxious to bring on war don't know what they are bargaining for," he wrote to his nephew. In February 1861, the failure of a Virginia-sponsored peace conference in Washington made Jackson so fearful of war that he called upon his pastor, the Reverend White, to talk about what might happen. "It is painful to discover with what unconcern they speak of war and threaten it," Jackson told him. "They do not know its horrors. I have seen enough of it to make me look upon it as the sum of all evils." His wife Anna offered a striking summary of his beliefs in those early days. "I have never heard any man express such an utter abhorrence of war," she wrote. "I shall never forget how he once exclaimed to me with all the intensity of his nature, 'Oh, how I deprecate war.'" But there was more to it than that. According to his sister-in-law, Maggie Preston, who was perhaps his closest friend, Jackson also recoiled physically at war's violence. His revulsions at scenes of horror, or even descriptions of them, she wrote, was almost inconsistent in one who had lived the life of a soldier. "He has told me that his first sight of a mangled and swollen corpse on a Mexican battlefield filled him with as much sickening dismay as if he had been a woman." And now he was prepared to do what he could to stop the imminent horror. His chosen form of activism was characteristic of the man: prayer. He would pray. He would petition God, and God would stop the madness. When he had thought about it some more, it occurred to him that he could do even more than that. So he went to the Reverend White with a proposal. "Do you not think that all the Christian people of the land," he asked White, "could be induced to unite in a concert of prayer to avert so great an evil. It seems to me that if they would thus unite in prayer, war might be prevented and peace preserved. Jackson believed in the power of prayer. Now he was proposing to harness the entire nation to that power, a gigantic, country-sweeping petition sent up to God. A national day of prayer to overturn the political idiocies of the past half-century. White encouraged him, and Jackson did what he could to make it happen. Since none of this correspondence on the subject has survived, we don't know how far he got with the plan. We do know that other Christians in other churches, perhaps sharing his sense of desperation, had proposed the same thing. He pursued it as best he could, writing letters to clergymen in the North and South. His name eventually appeared on several communications from Northern churches supporting the Day of Prayer. The event never came to pass. Jackson prayed ardently over it anyway. When he was called on in church to lead prayers, the wish he invariably expressed was that God would preserve the whole land from the evils of war. That did not mean he was not fully prepared to do his duty when the orders came down from Richmond. His main regret, it seemed, was that he was losing his precious Sabbath, the day appointed for the march. On the eve of his departure, he had told Anna that he hoped that the call to Richmond would not come before Monday, which would allow him to spend the Sabbath quietly, and without any mention of politics or the impending troubles of the country. When those orders came anyway, Jackson knelt somberly with her in their bedchamber on Sunday morning. In a quavering voice, he read from Corinthians and committed them both to the protection of God. His voice was so choked with emotion that he could scarce utter the words, wrote Anna. One of his most earnest petitions was that, if consistent with his will, God would still avert the threatening danger and grant us peace. Jackson still hadn't given up. He was ready to die for Virginia and for the South, but he still did not believe God was going to let this happen. If Jackson could seem at times like a Quaker pacifist in a country that was lunging eagerly toward war, there was also a hint in a letter written in January 1861 to his nephew, Thomas Jackson Arnold, of a darker, more complex view. In it, he repeated his desire to avert war, but added a qualifier that Arnold found so disturbing that he later edited it out of his own reverent biography of Jackson. "I am in favor of making a thorough trial for peace," wrote Jackson, "and if we fail in this, and the state is invaded to defend it with terrific resistance, even to taking no prisoners." Taking no prisoners. That idea was well outside the mainstream of American political and military thought at the time. No one in a position of power on either side was seriously considering a black flag war in the spring of 1861. Jackson went on to say that if the free states should endeavor to subjugate us and thus excite our slaves to servile insurrection in which our families will be murdered without quarter or mercy, it becomes us to wage a war as will bring hostilities to a speedy close. By that, he meant making war so brutally expensive for both sides that they would quickly sue for peace. He meant instant, total war. Amid Jackson's ardent peace prayers, these harder-edged, less charitable thoughts dwelt also. Chapter 2, The Imperfect Logic of War. Thus the contented domestic man, who did not want to leave his home and fight a war, and until the very last minute did not think he would have to. In the end, he chose war because he believed Virginia had no choice, and like most people in the United States of America, in the year 1861, Jackson's first loyalty was to his home state. What, then, had sent the professor and his cadets marching down the hill on that pleasant spring day? The answer is maddeningly complex, partly because Jackson's reasons for fighting had little to do with what had propelled the two sections into the war in the first place. nor were they the same reasons the seven states of the Lower South had seceded in late 1860 and early 1861. Virginia, with the most industry, the most manpower, and by far the most military talent in the Confederacy, had its own ideas, its own political logic, and its own destiny to fulfill. Jackson, quintessentially Virginian, must be seen in that light. What had driven the nation to the brink of war, as opposed to what Jackson and his BMI charges were thinking about that day, was a bitter and often bloody half-century-long clash over the question of the expansion of slavery. For most of that time, the abolition of slavery in the states where it existed had been a marginal issue. Radical Northerners such as William Lloyd Garrison and Henry Ward Beecher advocated it. The mainstream of the Republican Party, including Abraham Lincoln, did not. But what Lincoln and Republicans and Free Soilers and abolitionists of various stripes in the North absolutely did agree on, and were prepared to risk a good deal to get, was the severe restriction, if not the complete prohibition, of slavery in the nation's new territories and new states. All other political questions, such as those of states' rights, protective tariffs, and a national banking system, were subservient to this primal, paradigm-shattering, nation-defining question. The anti-slavery zealot John Brown arose from its darker places, as did the tortured legal arguments of the Dred Scott case. The argument, and eventually the war, were thus about the future, not the past. They were about the failure, on a grand scale and drawn out over five decades, of Americans to agree on what to do with their westward booming nation's three prodigious land acquisitions: the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, the annexation of the Oregon Territory from Britain in 1846, and the Mexican Cession that followed the Mexican-American War in 1848. Together, these acquisitions had added more than 1.7 million square miles of territory to the United States of America, dwarfing the 375,000 square miles of the original 13 colonies. They accounted for most of the land west of the Mississippi. The moral and political debate entailed an inevitable calculus of power. Whichever side, slave or free, added more states to its roster, the more its representational power grew, and with it the ability to determine the laws of the land. For the South, failure to add new states meant that its parochial interests would be slowly, surely choked to death. For the North, failure meant living in a nation of slaves, a possibility made frighteningly real by the Supreme Court's Dred Scott decision in 1857, ruling, in effect, that Congress had no authority to prohibit slavery in the territories. Neither outcome was remotely acceptable to the nation as a whole. The great political accommodations of the age, the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which prohibited slavery north of latitude 3630, with the exception of Missouri, the Compromise of 1850, a package of bills that admitted California as a free state, allowed the New Mexico and Utah territories to decide the slavery question by popular vote, and preserved slavery in Washington, D.C., and the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, which opened those territories to slavery based on popular vote, effectively repealing the Missouri Compromise, represented ever more shrill and ever more desperate attempts to level an unlevelable playing field. Those were the reasons the politicians, the statesmen, the newspaper editors, the lawyers, and the intellectuals went to war anyway. But they did not explain why the average soldier fought. They were not the reasons Virginians, such as Jackson and his cadets, would have given for wanting to fight Yankees. Jackson had remained generally aloof from national politics. As a slaveholder, he was aware of the congressional debate over slavery in the territories, but not deeply versed in it. He was like many ordinary Virginians of his day, a moderate, states' rights Democrat who favored keeping Washington's nose out of Virginia's business and working within the Union to resolve differences. He had no ideology. He was a Virginian. The cadets he taught, moreover, part of that great mass of young men who would do most of the war's fighting, would have had little understanding of the freakish political complexity of the Compromise of 1850, for example, which attempted to settle the question of slavery in what was essentially the entire American Southwest, plus California. Most would have been unable to parse the meaning of states' rights in the federal Constitution, or fully grasp the reasons for the disastrous splintering of the Democratic Party in 1860, a carefully planned conspiracy intended to inspire Southern secession, which had guaranteed the victory of Abraham Lincoln. Virginians were not stupid. They just had more provincial and personal views of the world than the men who rode to battle in the halls of Congress. Nor were the Virginians inclined as a whole to buy the idea, hawked loudly by the states of the Lower South, that Lincoln's election meant that the federal government was going to free the slaves and forcibly mix the two races. Lincoln had denied this categorically in his inaugural address. "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly," he said on March 4, 1861, little more than a month before the Confederate attack on Fort Sumter, "to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." Neither Jackson nor most of his fellow citizens in Lexington believed that the war was about staving off the immediate abolition of slavery. By and large, they abhorred the idea of secession. What made Jackson and his cadets want to fight, amid all this swirl of rhetoric, belief, ideology, and implicit threat, were events much closer to home. The first of those events was an invasion of the state of Virginia. It took place on October 16, 1859, a year and a half before the war's official start, when the radical abolitionist John Brown and 21 of his followers seized the federal arsenal at the River Junction town of Harper's Ferry in northern Virginia. Brown's object had been to secure muskets and use them to arm local slaves. He then planned to start a guerrilla war, whose object was to free all 491,000 slaves in Virginia. Having accomplished that, he would then head south, replicating his success in other states. The vision was vast, apocalyptic, and on its face, ridiculous. The raid was so poorly organized that it looked like a planned martyrdom. Brown never made it out of Harper's Ferry, nor did he even appear to have a plan for escaping, let alone arming hundreds of thousands of slaves. His raiding party managed to kill 7 townspeople and wound 10 others. Then a group of 86 U.S. Marines under Army Colonel Robert E. Lee arrived from Washington, stormed the building where Brown and his men were barricaded, and put a fast and violent end to Brown's gambit. 10 of the raiders were killed. Brown was captured and turned over to Virginia authorities, who, to avoid a lynching, brought him speedily to trial. On November 2, 1859, he was convicted of treason, conspiring with slaves to rebel, and murder, and sentenced to be hanged on December 2 in nearby Charlestown. Rumors, meanwhile, swept the countryside. Armed abolitionists were on the march, slaves were rising up, anti-slavery radicals were coming to Brown's rescue. None of it was true, but that hardly mattered. Brown's attack had been implausible enough. What fresh horrors would now descend on the South? In the days following Brown's sentencing, Virginia Governor Henry A. Wise summoned some 1,500 Virginia militiamen to Charlestown. They were put under the command of Colonel Francis H. Smith, Jackson's boss and the superintendent of VMI, who would supervise the execution itself. As additional security, Wise also ordered 85 cadets from VMI to Charlestown. In charge of them were Major William Gillam, commanding an infantry unit of 64 cadets, and Major Thomas J. Jackson, commanding an artillery unit of 21 cadets. On November 25, they traveled by stagecoach to Stanton, and from there took trains to Washington and on to Charlestown. The Richmond Daily Dispatch called them the best drilled troops on the ground. Upon arrival, Jackson wrote his wife Anna that "there are about 1,000 troops here, and everything is quiet." He added that 7 of us slept in the same room. On the day of Brown's execution, the cadets, armed and uniformed in gray trousers and red flannel shirts, crossed by 2 white belts and looking quite dashing, were stationed near the scaffold. Jackson's artillery unit was about 40 yards in front of it. His 2 howitzers, light, short-barreled cannons that were likely loaded with canister, turning them into the equivalent of large, sawed-off shotguns, were ready to sweep the field. Jackson, who had been an artillerist in the U.S. Army, attended to even the smallest details. He was ready for whatever might come. At 11 a.m., Brown was led to the gallows. One of the best accounts of what followed comes from Jackson himself, who recorded the event in a letter to his wife on the day of the execution. "He behaved with unflinching firmness," wrote Jackson, noting that Brown ascended the scaffold with apparent cheerfulness, and when asked if he wished to be signaled when the trapdoor was about to drop, replied that it made no difference, provided he wasn't kept waiting too long. Jackson then described the death itself. "Brown fell through about 5 inches, his knees falling on a level with the position occupied by his feet before the rope was cut. With the fall, his arms, below the elbows, flew up horizontally, his hands clenched, and his arms gradually fell, but by spasmodic motions. There was very little motion of his person for several moments, and soon the wind blew his lifeless body to and fro. His face, upon the scaffold, was turned a little east of south, and in front of him were the cadets, commanded by Major Gillam." Jackson was clearly mesmerized by what he saw, fascinated by both the means of death and Brown's stoic behavior. "I was much impressed with the thought that before me stood a man in the full vigor of health, who must, in a few moments, enter eternity. I sent up the petition that he might be saved. Awful was the thought that he might in a few minutes receive the sentence, 'Depart, ye wicked, into everlasting fire.' I hope that he was prepared to die, but I'm doubtful. He refused to have a minister with him." Thus Jackson, a firm believer in the punishments of hell, had sent up a prayer for the salvation of the soul of John Brown, a condemned murderer whom Jackson saw, incorrectly, as a godless man. In fact, Brown, who had modeled himself on biblical patriarchs and believed he had been called by God to rid the world of slavery, was every bit as devout as Jackson. Jackson could not see him that way, of course. He considered Brown a murderer. It is noteworthy that the two men would later be compared by Northerners, who, in their attempt to understand Jackson's character, found important similarities between them. And indeed, in the broadest sense, they were not altogether wrong. Both John Brown and Thomas Jackson were hard, righteous, and uncompromising men, religious warriors in the tradition of Oliver Cromwell, the ardently Christian political and military leader in the English Civil War. Both believed beyond doubt that God was on their side. Both believed that they were agents of God, and that by killing the enemy they were doing his work. Jackson would have bridled at any such comparison. He saw murder, as opposed to killing men in an official war, as violating God's law. Though his armies later sent many Yankee soldiers to their graves, there is never any evidence that Jackson, a stickler for duty and obedience, knowingly broke any law. What happened in the weeks and months after Brown's trial and execution amounted to an almost instant revision of history, and it changed entirely the meaning of his raid in the minds of everyone in slave and non-slave America. The first perceptions of Brown and his attack on Harper's Ferry were easily categorized. He may have thought he was working to abolish slavery, but in fact he was delusional, perhaps even insane. And it followed that Brown and his cohort were only a tiny splinter group of radicals and did not represent the way most abolitionists in the North actually felt. That was certainly the quickly expressed view in the North. The anti-slavery Worcester spy in Massachusetts called it one of the rashest and maddest enterprises ever. Arch-abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison thought that, though it might have been well-intended, it was also misguided, wild, and apparently insane. But at his trial, Brown had surprised everyone. He was not only coolly rational, but also remarkably eloquent. "I deny everything but what I have all along admitted," he said, "of a design on my part to free the slaves. Had I interfered in the manner which I admit, in behalf of the rich, the powerful, the intelligent, the so-called great, every man in this court would have deemed it an act worthy of reward rather than punishment. This court acknowledges, too, as I suppose, the validity of the law of God. I see a book kissed, which I suppose to be the Bible, or at least the New Testament, which teaches me that all things whatsoever that men should do to me, I should do so even to them. Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children, and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say let it be done. Brown's words and his self-possession in the courtroom changed everything. These were not the words of a madman and a murderer, as Northerners now saw it, but of a principled religious man who insisted that his purpose had not been to incite rebellion, but simply to arm slaves for their self-defense. The change of perception swept quickly through the non-slave states in the days following the trial. The day he was executed, church bells had tolled in many northern towns and cities. Guns fired salutes, sermons were preached on the purity and correctness of his motives, and people all over the North prayed for the soul of this martyr to liberty. Brown's death was no longer an oddity. It was, suddenly, a sensation. Henry David Thoreau called him a crucified hero. William Dean Howells, a leading Northern intellectual, wrote that Brown has become an idea, 1,000 times purer and better and loftier than the Republican idea. Everyone was suddenly talking about the grandeur and nobility of the man, the rightness of what he had done. The reaction of Southerners to such Northern expressions of sympathy was horror, mixed with disbelief, that their brethren could possibly wish upon them the fate that Brown had planned. To Southerners, and particularly to Virginians, whose state had been invaded, Brown was a terrifying figure, the dark, avenging side of the anti-slavery movement that had been on view for 5 years in the bloody Civil War in Kansas, where Brown and his Free State volunteers had murdered 5 men in 1856. He had, after all, intended to arm slaves and set them free, which presumably meant setting them upon their masters, which meant that people in Connecticut and Massachusetts were now endorsing the violent deaths of white men, women, and children all over the South. "This mad attempt by a handful of vulgar cutthroats and its condign punishment," wrote the Reverend Robert Louis Dabney, an important Presbyterian leader in the South and later chief of Jackson's staff, "would have been a very trivial affair to the Southern people, but for the manner in which it was regarded by the people of the North. Their presses, pulpits, public meetings, and conversations disclosed such a hatred of the South and its institutions as to lead them to justify the crime, involving, though it did, the most aggravated robbery, treason, and murder, and to exalt the bloodthirsty fanatic who led the party to a public apotheosis." These sentiments were replicated all over the South, and the complaints became more grievous as more became known about the wealthy Northern benefactors who had helped Brown finance his enterprise. Wrote Henry Kidd Douglas, a Virginian and another member of Jackson's staff in the war, "There is nothing in the history of fanaticism, its crimes and follies, so strange and inexplicable as that the people of New England, with all their shrewdness and general sense of justice, should have attempted to lift up the sordid name of that old wretch and to exalt him among the heroes and benefactors of this land. Why they should have sent him money and arms to encourage him to murder the white people of Virginia is beyond my comprehension." Though some Northern politicians tried to blunt the effect of the Northern response, the damage, and it was very deep, emotional damage, had been done. The reaction to the event now loomed larger than the event itself. "The Harper's Ferry invasion has advanced the cause of disunion more than any event that has happened since the formation of the government," wrote the Richmond Whig and the Richmond Inquirer under a single byline. "Thousands of men, who a month ago scoffed at the idea of a dissolution of the Union, now hold the opinion that its days were numbered." In Jackson's letter to his nephew in January 1861, in which he had put forward the disturbing idea of a black flag war, his pointed reference, "If the free states excite our slaves to servile insurrection in which our families will be murdered without quarter or mercy," was to John Brown's raid. It had apparently changed Jackson's way of thinking about his northern brethren, too. Still, Jackson had remained, like the town of Lexington, strong for the Union. Indeed, most of the state of Virginia, in spite of this new sense of vulnerability, remained in favor of the Union. But all this would change, with astounding speed, over the course of 3 days in the month of April, 1861. There had been a sort of giddiness in the air anyway that winter and spring. Lincoln's election on December 20, 1860 had prompted the immediate secession of 7 southern states: South Carolina, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Texas. Society in the Old Dominion and other border states trembled with anticipation. Of what, nobody quite knew, though perhaps it was simply the possibility of moral clarity after so much political bombast. Whatever the cause, an odd sort of social intoxication seemed to grow in direct proportion to the bitterness and fatalism of the political debate, and it took the outward form of happiness. The winter of 1860-1861 was with us one of unprecedented gaiety, wrote Confederate memoirist Charles Minor Blackford of the town of Lynchburg, though he could have been describing many other Virginia towns. The spirit of fun and frolic seemed to take possession of our people, both young and old, and for months entertainments were given. Party after party succeeded each other in rapid succession. Though Virginia remained within the Union, secession flags were being raised all across the state, including on the campuses of VMI and Washington College. In one instance, Major Jackson had discovered a piece of cloth hanging from a flagpole where the American flag usually hung. It turned out to be a crude secession flag with the words, "Hurrah for South Carolina," written in shoeblacking. Jackson ordered it removed. Public debates had meanwhile grown more and more strident. Jackson's father-in-law, for example, Dr. George Junkin, president of Washington College, was strongly critical of anyone who supported secession. He became a fixture at the increasingly common public gatherings, once arguing that secession was the essence of all immorality. The issue of secession came to a head for Lexington and for Jackson on the evening of April 13. VMI cadets who supported secession marched from campus into town, where they were greeted by a hostile, overwhelmingly pro-Union crowd consisting mostly of members of a local militia company. There was some pushing and shoving, and a few threats were issued, but peace held, and the secessionists soon hoisted their 15-star flag of the Southern Confederacy with the motto "Union of the South" from a pole erected near the courthouse. Speeches were made, including several by VMI faculty members. Pleased with its success, the secessionist group started to disperse. The Unionist group stepped forward and raised the Stars and Stripes on its own pole. But the cadets had managed the night before to sabotage the pole, which snapped and fell. The cadets cheered. At that point, the mood of the assembled crowd changed. Taunts were made, blows exchanged. An intoxicated militiaman drew a revolver and knife on several cadets. When one cadet returned to the institute and announced that cadets were being assaulted by Unionists, the effect was instant and magical, wrote former cadet Charles Copeland White. Everyone rushed for his gun and a cartridge box, and then all rushed pell-mell for town. Almost 200 of them arrived, loaded their muskets, fixed bayonets, and prepared to charge the militiamen who seemed fully prepared to stand their ground. Into the incipient battle now strode Colonel Francis H. Smith, the school superintendent, along with several faculty members, including Jackson. He insisted that he was their commander and that if they were going to fight, it would be under his command. With Jackson's help, he managed to stop them and persuade them to return to their barracks. It is unclear exactly what Jackson did, but according to the local Presbyterian minister, were it not for his intervention, blood would have been shed. When the cadets got back to the institute, still in high spirits, Smith berated them for being unwise and unsoldierly. Then two other professors stepped forward with their own, more gentle remarks. As they spoke, however, cries went up through the hall. No one was sure if they were serious or joking, for Old Jack to address the crowd. Considering who Jackson was, what the cadets apparently thought of him, and the gravity of the situation, it was a strange request. Still, Smith seemed to think it was a good idea, too. He turned to Jackson, who was seated next to him. "I have driven the nail in," he said, "but it needs clinching. Speak with them." To the surprise of many of the cadets, Jackson mounted the rostrum. For those who witnessed it, what happened next was an astounding transformation, one that many would talk about for decades to come. "Military men make short speeches," Jackson began, in a tone of voice unfamiliar to his charges. "And as for myself, I am no hand at speaking anyhow." There was something about his voice that caught the cadets' attention, a hint that the man on the rostrum was no longer their eccentric professor, a man they sometimes called Tom Fool, the object of teasing and jokes around the Institute. Jackson continued, "The time for war has not yet come, but it will come, and that soon. And when it does come, my advice is to draw the sword and throw away the scabbard." That was all. Draw the sword and throw away the scabbard. Perhaps it was the simplicity of those words, or their saber-thrust directness. But as Jackson turned and stepped to his seat, the room, until now tense and murmurous, erupted in a series of cheers, one after another, that rang through the barracks. The force of his words, their sheer implausibility, had shocked and dazzled the young men. Instead of the awkward physics teacher, what they saw before them was a soldier, and watching his flashing eyes and intent expression, they were reminded of those stories of the Mexican-American War they had heard. "Hurrah for Old Jack!" they shouted, themselves amazed that they were hurrahing the eccentric major, and continued shouting it long after the meeting was dismissed. And they never forgot it. 50 years later, one of them wrote, "The thrilling effect of those words is felt by the writer to this day. They touched the heart of every boy who heard them, and men now gray will tell of the enthusiastic cheers which drowned all further speeches." Now the tide of secession and war began to sweep in quickly. What settled the matter for Virginians, with the same galvanizing speed with which the attack on Sumter had united the North, was a proclamation, issued on April 15 by Abraham Lincoln, calling on the states that had not seceded to provide 75,000 troops to maintain the honor, the integrity, and the existence of our national Union, and also to execute the laws of the Union and suppress rebellions. Virginians knew what this meant, armed coercion. It meant that 2,340 Sons of Virginia, the state's quota, were going to be used as a military force against the Sons of Georgia and Texas and other Confederate states. If Lincoln was calling for war on the Confederate States of America, the subtext was also clear. These troops would be used against any state that left the Union. The reaction in Virginia was swift and this time sure. Governor John Letcher, a pragmatist who had opposed secession, now cabled furiously back to Washington on the 16th. "I have only to say that the militia of Virginia will not be furnished to the powers at Washington for any such use or purposes as they have in view," he wrote. "Your object is to subjugate the southern states, and a requisition made upon me for such an object will not be complied with. You have chosen to inaugurate civil war." On April 17, Virginians learned that their militia had already been dispatched to seize both the federal armory at Harper's Ferry and the enormous naval yard at Norfolk. That same day, the state convention voted 88-55 to secede from the Union, though Jackson's Shenandoah Valley voted 12-5 against secession. If the cadets who marched to Richmond with Thomas Jackson 4 days later had been asked why they were doing it, few would have replied that it was because of their convictions about slavery, or their beliefs about state sovereignty, or any of the other great national questions that had been debated for so long. They would have told you then, as most of Stonewall Jackson's soldiers in the Army of the Confederate States of America would have told you later, that they were fighting to repel the invaders, to drive the northern aggressors from their homeland. That was why Virginia went to war. The great and complicated political reasons for secession, thundered about in Congress and in the state legislatures, were not their reasons, which were more like those expressed by a captive Confederate soldier, who was not a slaveholder, to his puzzled Union captors. "I'm fighting because you're down here," he said.